The Burroughs of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burroughs of Berea.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Burroughs of Berea. I am your host tonight, Tiziana Mom So Hard Severse.
How are you momming so hard today? Do you have another one?
Oh, how am I momming so hard today? No, I don't have another one. Oh, man. I already recorded a couple of episodes today, I already had a couple of them. And I didn't think anyone was going to ask me. Usually, Rick asks me.
I put her right on the spot.
directly on the spot. But that's okay. That's okay. Go listen to the Notes from the Underground. You'll hear all kinds of ways I'm momming so hard. To my right, we have Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
And directly next to him, straight out of Compton, Ralph Hicks.
Represent.
He says with a cough drop in his mouth.
The sultry wars have begun.
It is.
And then behind the glass, as usual, is Rocket Man Andy Bishop.
Yeah, we can't do this without you. This is kind of like a Yahtzee episode right here because we just shook it up and this is who showed up.
Yeah. We're missing Billy. We're missing Sarita, who had some car troubles. And we're missing your usual host.
Your general host.
Rick Welch, because his wife got a grant, and so he's
something.
So he's going to be going doing that, which is good. Our guest tonight is joining us via Zoom, and I'm really excited about this. I met her while I was working on my master's at ILIF University. She's an incredible human being. Not only is she a professor at ILIF, she's also a licensed psychotherapist. She's an ordained minister and a much published author. And in fact, her book, The Practice of Pastoral Care, A Postmodern Approach, the Revised and Expanded Edition, is a standard textbook in clinical pastoral education all over the U.S.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Dr. Carrie Doering, thanks for being here today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, you guys might remember, and some of you listeners as well, when we did our anniversary episode, I talked about how that I gave you guys the imagery of like the aspen trees and the roots.
Yep.
That's from Dr. Doering.
That was a good analogy.
Yeah, I got that from her. And I was just telling her before we started recording how grateful I've been for that imagery because of how isolating it's been being a stay-at-home mom this last year.
How the aspen trees, the roots reconnect and they get nurtured from each other.
Yeah, exactly. So Dr. Doering's going to be a part of our testimony series this week. Huh. And and I'm sad Sarita's not here too. But
Who darkens the door but Billy Eye Candy Kimsey? Let's grab him in real quick.
Oh, my gracious.
Go ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, we give you Billy Eye Candy Kimsey.
He's going to sit down and put his headphones on and get that
like
mic.
Like a peep in an air fryer. A hot mess.
Nice. There we go.
That was a good one.
I'm so happy that I can just do the same thing every time because I'm just not that witty.
Well, what happens is when we record multiple episodes in a day, I get mommed out. So it's like I forget. You know, I'm never prepared. Yeah. That was a total fail on my part. I literally thought you guys weren't going to ask me how I mom so hard today.
In introductions. I'm sorry I interrupted.
So, anywho, we're talking with Dr. Carrie Doering. And, you know, so Carrie, when we do our testimony series, which is what you're here to tell us your story, when we do our testimony series, we always start with a simple question. Mm-hmm. To your earliest recollection, when is the first time you remember hearing the name of Jesus?
Well, I guess because I was raised Catholic, mm-hmm. I would have heard it going to church every Sunday. But mm-hmm. I don't have a particular memory of hearing that name.
A lot of people don't.
Yeah.
Some people do, but a lot of people don't. Yeah.
You were raised Catholic and going to church and having a relationship with God, that was just sort of part of the standard practice in your home?
Well, it was complicated because my mother was a very devout Catholic, and my father was agnostic. He was a professor of psychology. And so she was raised in a Catholic tradition with a pretty strong judging God and a very strong rule system. So that's what I absorbed from her, that if you didn't follow the rules, you'd be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And what, how did your, that must have made for some very differenting parenting styles, I imagine, too.
Yeah. So I there was this tension in our family between my mother's Catholicism, following the rules, and if you didn't follow the rules, it'd be terrible consequences. And then my father's kind of aloof intellectual, I would have to say scorn, really, for religion. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
That is complicated.
Yeah.
So what happened? So at what point then did Christianity or Catholicism become your own? Because growing up in this environment, you know, you had this option to choose. So how did that happen?
Well, I was when I was in third grade, I started singing in a choir, and that was what I now see as a very profoundly spiritual experience. And from that point on, music was the way I connected with goodness.
That's cool.
When I studied at McGill University, I did a degree in music. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I did a degree in school music and also got involved in singing in choirs. That was my passion, singing in choirs, and sang in a little church choir in Montreal that was very Scottish, blue collar. And then I became the organist and the choir director. It was a tiny little church. And they voted me on their board of managers, even though everybody was like in their 60s. And I was, I don't know, like 20 at the time. And the minister was getting his MDiv at McGill. And he was very, I would say, almost adversarial, like in your face all the time. So he and I used to argue constantly because I didn't believe anything, and I'd sit at the organ knitting furiously during the sermon.
Oh, gracious. Oh, you heretic.
And then after choir rehearsal, we'd go out and have beer, Canadian beer. It was very strong. And he got me reading the Gospel of John one day, and I took a lot of courses on literature, literary theory, as part of my degree. And it was, honestly, I would have to say it was a conversion experience. Looking back, I read the Gospel of John from beginning to end, and I read a commentary that gave a critical perspective. And it just blew me away. I just was blown away by the beauty of it, but it was also kind of rending experience where I just cried and cried and cried because I knew now I had to grapple with the power of the text, you know, even just as a literary text.
Mm-hmm.
So I was finishing up my music degree and realizing I didn't want to teach music and decided I would just go right into an MDiv degree at McGill. There was no student debt. I hardly paid any tuition. So I went right into an MDiv, and I've always been a very pragmatic person, and I thought, you know, being a minister would be interesting. You'd write a sermon every week, and I love talking to people. I like finding out their stories. So then I had to convince the Presbyterian Church in Canada, because that was the congregation I just ended up in by chance, to ordain me, and it was only the second year they ever ordained women.
Wow.
And at first, the first time they said no, because I told them I was skeptical about a lot of things. So then my mentor minister, this very adversarial guy, said, no, you have to tell them why they should ordain you. So I went back in, and they did ordain me, and I was sent to, at that point, to be ordained, you had to be willing to go anywhere in the world.
Wow.
But they sent me to these two village churches in Ontario, and they didn't want a woman, but they were so small they couldn't like call their own minister. They had to accept an appointment. So they got me, and I was 24. I looked like I was 18.
This sounds like a Netflix series.
Yeah, like young.
This is so fascinating.
Yeah, young and female at a difficult time to be that where you were.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, they loved me. I preached short sermons. They loved short sermons. And I did funerals. I did funerals very well. And I did spiritual care visits very well. And about 6 months in, a young married man who struggled with unrelenting depression escaped, you'd have to say escaped from the behavioral health hospital where he was being a patient. And he went home and ended his life. And his wife found himself there, found him there. And I did that funeral. It was a very, very hard funeral to do. My grandfather had just ended his life.
Wow.
So I preached a funeral. This was in 1978, about depression being like a cancer, you know, some kinds of depression. And this young man was in this intergenerational family that had been like just a cornerstone family in that church. And they were very, very comforted by what I said. And I think it demonstrated that even though I was very young and I was very shy, self-conscious, introverted, I think what equipped me to do this was, ever since I was like in fourth grade, I read novels like just constantly. And so I had lived in this world of literature. And when I first got to this church and I started visiting families, I would think, this is just like so-and-so's novel.
All right. So you know? You've got these examples, these case examples that you might not have had just from your regular life to work off of. That's great. What's an early, just pick one early book that you love that you kind of from early in your life that you still hang on to a little bit.
You know, I, oddly enough, there were some series, like children's series, that my sisters and I just read over and over and over again. Like Elizabeth Enright was one. You would never hear of her nowadays, but then I got into adult literature, and I remember, I think the first adult novel I read was The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck, which had some amazing like sex in it. But then when I was doing my MDiv, I was very good friends with a PhD student who was writing a dissertation on Iris Murdoch, who was this British philosopher who also wrote novels just about kind of, she's a lot of Freudian theory, which is very outdated now, just about how people fall in love. It's very intense, just the complexities and intensity of human relationships. So when I would go visit these elderly women, I'd go once a month and they'd start telling me their stories. To me, I could just imagine all this drama behind the story, you know? I think more than anything else, that equipped me.
Yeah, for this experience that you had.
Yeah.
6 months in. Well, and what a different what a different environment that must have been. I'm you know, thinking about this. What a very different environment from, you know, the kind of stringent Catholicism that you were raised in, because here you are, you're getting your MDiv, so you're doing that thing, but you're being exposed to all these different thinkers and the different writers. And then now here you are in this community, embedded in a community rather than, you know, embedded in a structure or a church. And that must have been very different. Was that, did that cause you to reckon at all?
The Presbyterian Church in Canada and also the Presbyterian Church USA is a very educated tradition. Like you have to learn New Testament Greek, you have to learn Hebrew Bible. So it's a very intellectual tradition. So I had colleagues who were, you know, intellectual peers. In a way, my father was an experimental psychologist, so he had a very narrow field. But these were, and I've always found this true of a lot of clergy, certainly of chaplains, that the wise ones, you can talk to them about anything. And they bring a very balanced perspective. But it was a wonderfully supportive collegial community. The congregation was quite different from me in lots of ways, but very, very caring. Very caring, yeah.
So how long did you pastor those two churches?
I was there for 9 years, and had my eldest son there. And then I decided I would do a PhD. When I was in my third year, I was getting very frustrated with myself and my pastoral visit. So I decided to do a unit of clinical pastoral education, which is the kind of chaplaincy training, and met with the supervisor, who was phenomenal. He was just this amazing, amazing mentor. It turned out he was a leader, what you call a pastoral theologian, in Canada. Then I decided to do a master's degree with him part-time while I was pastoring. So I did a master's degree.
On top of your master's of divinity at this point.
Yes.
So this is your dual master's, master's number two.
Yes, and it involved being trained as a marriage and family therapist and also taking courses and writing a master's thesis. And when my older son was born, I had to reckon with a childhood experience of sexual assault by a stranger. I went on a silent retreat after Jordan was born, and the memories of this experience I had at 13 just came up and totally overwhelmed me at this Jesuit retreat center. So I had to really work on that. And I did a lot of work on it. I wrote about it. I joined a rape crisis group. And then I decided when I was writing my master's thesis, I was using a psychological approach that focused a lot on dreams. So I decided I would interview women who had been sexually assaulted on the repetitive dreams they had. So I interviewed about 17 women. And then I did a kind of a thematic analysis. It was very, very compelling. So then when I went to do my PhD, I wanted to do more work on childhood experiences of violence and how women experienced God. So that's what I ended up writing my PhD on. I went to Boston University. I had been born in the U.S. because my dad had been a academic in the U.S. and moved to McGill. So I had U.S. citizenship, which luckily allowed me to then study in the U.S. and be able to work in the U.S. So I was very fortunate, like, in my early career, like, doors opened. It was a lot easier then than it is nowadays. So then I did my PhD at Boston University and wrote a dissertation on experiences of violence and how that was associated with the images of God that women had as adults. So childhood violence and adult women's images of God.
That's incredible. How many people were doing that kind of work when you were doing that kind of work? Specifically looking at women and the way that they interpreted God and the way they experienced God.
Yeah, it was early days, but there was a tradition of research on images of God. And I was fortunate to have a colleague in the psych department at BU who had just written a really helpful dissertation on images of God. And then that was when very influential books were published by Judith Herman, book on trauma, Bessel van der Kolk,
Body Keeps
Judith
the Score.
Herman. Yeah, were starting their victims of violence program in Cambridge. So there was a lot happening.
Yeah, that was like PTSD was new.
Yes.
That was a brand new disorder that people were starting to, and again, because of Bessel van der Kolk's work, right, that people were starting to recognize and that it had these sort of patterns and that specifically children that were being treated like they were just defiant or whatever, they actually were experiencing these post-traumatic stress responses. That sounds like it was a really like heavy couple of years for you?
It was, but my whole career has been about using my own experiences as kind of case studies. Mm-hmm. So writing about my own experience of sexual assault and how that shaped my experience of God, how I experienced the goodness of my body. And then, as you know, Diana, the younger of my two sons, Alex, who mm-hmm. was born in Boston just as I finished my PhD, from the time he was 17 till he was 27, experienced just very, very profound psychological struggles. Mm-hmm. And my second husband, Alex's stepfather, and I spent a lot of time trying to get good care for him. But he did end his life. It was about 5 years ago when he was 27. Mm-hmm. So that was another very, very profound experience. Really around like the moral stress, the spiritual struggles of being a mother trying to care for a son with really profound struggles.
Right, right. Tell me more about that, the moral struggles of that as a mom.
Well, you know, whenever I talk about this, I just want to take a minute because the reason I talk about my own experience is so many people struggle with despair. Mm-hmm. And so many parents struggle to know how to help their kids. And so I like to take a moment just to take a deep breath. And I always put my hand on my heart. And I want all the listeners to pause and just name anyone they hold in their heart mm-hmm. when we talk about this. You know, I hold Alex in my heart. And I've learned to say when I talk about this and I grieve Alex, I say, I miss you, Alex. I love you, Alex. Mm-hmm. So just to take a moment to just take a deep breath. And who's ever listening, if you wish to say out loud the name of someone you're remembering or say your own name if you're remembering your own struggles. Mm. And when we bring ourselves and our loved ones in like this, my hope is we can weave a net that can hold us all when we experience despair. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes no matter what we do, our loved ones will choose to end their lives. That's Alex struggled for many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I've come to understand his choice. Mm.
That's really, that's a powerful statement right there. And yeah. Must have required an enormous amount of wrestling on your own.
Well, I think the struggle is to keep my relationship with Alex alive. Like mm-hmm. there's a temptation to fill in all the missing pieces of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And to say, now I understand. But then that closes me off to the mystery of who Alex was and is and the mystery of who he is to me. So I try to be open, like even in our conversation now, mm-hmm. I'll see things in different ways because we're talking to you're unique, I'm unique, mm-hmm. your listeners are unique. So we create new meanings out of just sharing these stories. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether in your home, auto, suitcase, or hotel, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know that your items are secure in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistol by make and model, compact size or full size. They come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designative, protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So to protect what matters most, visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. enter code Burrows, that's B-U-R-R-O-S, at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter Burrows at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
Well, and that's one of the things I think that came up. And the reason that the Rick had me reach out to you is because when we were discussing in our anniversary episode, you know, Sarita was mentioning that she had struggled, her son had struggled with attempted suicide. And when she tried to reach out to Christian people and create community and create connection, she was just stonewalled left and right. Because I think it's difficult for, especially sometimes in a Christian community where suffering is associated with sin, that suffering is associated with mistakes, that suffering comes inevitably with the trappings of fault attached to it. It makes it difficult for Christians to admit or talk about their struggles or talk about their pain with one another, especially when it comes to something so so personal and so devastating as losing a loved one that has chosen to end their own life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of struggles when I was pulling together the memorial service. We wanted to do it in the Episcopal church where my husband had been an assistant priest. We had worshiped there as a family. Alex himself was, I'd say he was more agnostic, and he used Buddhist practices as I do. But we decided to create a memorial service there for him. And I told the rector, who was a very, very dear person, that I just couldn't have any references to resurrection. Because we were in lament. And resurrection seemed like an easy way to curtail all the questions and the sadness. And I wanted to focus on the love of God. And there was a New Zealand funeral service that, in the Episcopal tradition, the Anglican tradition, that was its focus, the love of God. So we used that. And it was really challenging to think of what scripture text, because the gospel text, because the ones I thought of, like the lost coin, the lost sheep, all had reference to sinners, you know? Mm. And it was my close friend, Sheila Devaney, who was the widow of my dear colleague, Larry Kent Graham at ILIF, who suggested the story, the parable of the Samaritan who helps the wounded traveler. And I wrote an article about this, and if readers would like to see it, they could email me. It's my first initial C and my last name, Doehring, at ILIFF, ILIFF.edu. So I wrote an article about, right, pulling together the funeral service. And I had excerpts from this sermon that Elizabeth gave. And she wove together the imagery of God holding Alex in love. And it was just so beautiful. So beautiful. And then I chose music. We have a very, very good choir there that really spoke to kind of lament, but with the beauty of music holding our sadness. And it was a very, very, this is an incredible way of remembering Alex with those around us who had loved him and loved us. But it was really hard to do initially because I had a lot of spiritual struggle about whether my priest would veto my ruling out resurrection in a funeral service.
Yeah. But it sounds like but it was really important to you that you were able to sit with your grief in that service instead of just skip to the next part. Let's lightly touch on the grief part and then let's skip to the part that doesn't feel so bad.
Right.
Yeah.
And resurrection, has so many different meanings to do with judgment too, you know? And I think that's why it's hard sometimes for Christians. I think the bottom line is that it's very, very frightening for a parent to encounter a parent like me whose son did end their lives. We always hope, our deepest hope, is that something will help, something will change things all around. And lots of times that does happen, but sometimes it doesn't for lots of different reasons. And then that's the fear that somehow what happened to me is contagious, you know.
Yeah, which is even more isolating.
You can see it's like a natural human response. Like a lot of people would say to me, well, did he have good therapists? And they'd say, I have a really good therapist. As a way of saying, well, this one happened to me because I have a really good therapist.
It's like warding off the hex.
What kind of medication was he on? You know, there are medications. Or did he try this? Did he try that? One thing that really helped was I found a therapist through my employee assistance program who really understood Alex's struggles. So she kept reminding me over and over and over again of what the research says about these kinds of struggles.
Right.
Because most people don't have that kind of in-depth knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And people do tend to have this like way of, they hear about a problem and it's the first time they've heard about it. And they kind of give a lot of step one answers. And that's, I don't know if it's worth saying that's not their fault. It's just like when you call up tech support and the first thing they say is it plugged in? And you're like, yes, thank you.
You know? Great point, Andy.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of one thing I think I noticed taking your classes, because I took a class on pastoral counseling and care, intro to pastoral counseling care and moral injury, is the bravery and consistency with which in an academic setting you were writing about this experience, you were talking about this experience, you were inviting other people that may or may not be walking around hiding their own struggles and their own griefs in an academic setting to step into that pain and share, you know, which is again something that we don't do, especially in academia.
It's true, but I teach chaplains and I teach religious leaders, and I teach them micro skills, like how to be the best chaplain they can. And, you know, when I was grieving Alex's death, I have to say that my faculty colleagues were extraordinarily supportive. Like, it's so hard for most people to have family and trusted others with whom they can talk about this stuff, because most people are too scared to talk about it. But the place where I teach, I could share my grief. When I teach chaplains, I do a lot of teaching in the context with other chaplains. Chaplains can hear this stuff. That is their training. And so it's an extraordinary community to be part of.
How long have you been at ILIF?
Since 2003.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you were there through this whole entire experience and were able to be sort of supported by the same staff through this entire experience.
Yeah.
What are you up to now?
Well, I'm in my last academic term of teaching. I'm retiring May 31st.
Congratulations.
No.
Thank you.
It's not congratulations, because when I go back to ILIF to finish my master, she's not going to be there. I'm just kidding. No, congratulations. What did you say, Ralph?
She'll be there in spirit.
Yeah, she'll be there in spirit.
Yeah, that's right.
You can call her on the phone.
Yeah.
We do have a type of connection.
But also, I have a contract with the Navy. 3-year contract with several colleagues, Zachary Moon, who teaches at Chicago Theological Seminary, who's a retired Navy chaplain and has written on military moral injury, and Trace Haythorne, who used to head the Association of Clinical Pastoral Education. So we developed curriculum for Navy chaplains and their teams. And then between January and June, we go and teach these three-day curriculums at Navy bases in the U.S., Europe, and Japan.
Wow. That's incredible. So you're all over the place. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful context to teach in because in the military, you work with people of all faiths and no faiths. And because military chaplains have absolute confidentiality, mm-hmm. a lot of service members will go and talk to the team in the chaplain's office about problems that they would not want to talk with a psychologist about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a very rich opportunity to provide support. And even though I'm at a school that is very critical often of the U.S. military, my former colleague, Larry Kent Graham, and I made a commitment a number of years ago that to support and educate military chaplains, because the work they do as chaplains supporting service members is just profoundly important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And difficult, I would imagine. Talk about an at-risk population. I mean, especially, yeah. I guess I'm referring specifically and especially to people actually in like conflict zones and stuff. But yeah,
right.
There would certainly be a lot of work to do there.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if we have people, I mean, the reason that we, I think the reason Rick wanted me to reach out to you again is because there's, like you'd said, there's likely other people that have struggled with losing a loved one or have struggled themselves with the suicidal ideations. You know, if we have people that are listening out there now and they're looking for resources, do you have any resources that you would recommend or places where people can turn when they're struggling? Not just, you know, I know we have suicide prevention, but groups, like support groups for people who've experienced this sort of loss.
Yeah. Well, of course, everybody should know about the suicide hotline 988 that was established a couple of years ago. And from what I've read about it, it works very, very well. The complicated thing about reaching out for help is to know that the type of person you're reaching out to help for may be required to get a suicide assessment for you, and that can carry risks. Mm-hmm. So when I teach religious leaders and chaplains how to do this, we talk a lot about that if someone were to come to me as a chaplain or a minister, and as soon as I had the sense that they might be struggling with thoughts of depression or despair, I would say, I really want to hang in there with you. I want to help you. And I am not mandated to report. Now, if I'm a chaplain in a hospital, I might be.
Yeah.
But I want you to know that we're going to try to access various kinds of support. And some of that support may want you to come to an emergency room and get assessed. And if you do that, they may require you to stay there. So just to lay out the possible consequences is really important. Most times I ask people what their support system is, what has helped in the past. Mm-hmm.
I saw something the other day that was it was very tongue-in-cheek, ha-ha, about how I feel terrible, but I can't say anything to anybody about being depressed because I will lose my job.
Doesn't that seem very counterintuitive in itself?
Yeah. It's like a level higher than kind of a social prohibition. There's a legalistic prohibition.
You go on a list.
As well. Exactly. Yeah, that's rough.
And that has implications for a lot of things, for jobs.
Oh, yeah.
It does.
For teaching positions, for getting guns.
None of which is insurance, said to be discouraging.
Whether you would be taken off of an insurance or denied insurance
because
of it.
I'm wondering how often people that take that first step in that direction, mm-hmm. thinking that it's a positive direction to help because it's so promoted mm-hmm. that you should call that yes. number, you should get involved in that. Mm-hmm. And then you go through that experience and then you're like, I'm not doing that again, you know, and I'm not.
There are anonymous helplines. The San Francisco Night Ministry runs an anonymous helpline. And they are a program that also trains chaplains. And I talked to a student of mine recently that did a training there. She was a chaplain on the hotline. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like a very helpful program. You know, they have some people that call back over and over again because they're so isolated and alone. And this is the one place where they can find someone to talk to.
Well, that's a lot of that is thanks to COVID and kids sitting in their room on their phones or their iPads right. on social media.
Yes, there's I think it's going to be a very influential book that was just published by Jonathan Haidt, Haidt, mm-hmm. called the, I think it's called The Generation of Anxiety. And he's compiled a lot of research that shows that in 2010, when adolescents started using phones that could access the internet, there was this dramatic shift, and that girls in particular, their rates of anxiety and depression skyrocketed.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good book. I've already started it, and he has a website called The Anxious Generation.
The Anxious Generation.
And there's a lot of information. In fact, I bought a book for my brother because he has little kids.
Yeah.
But the website is anxiousgeneration.com, Free the Anxious Generation. I think you're absolutely right. In 10 years, we're going to see the whole world go left because of the anxiety and things that are going on.
Now, interestingly enough, I've just started listening to the book, and he notes that among more traditional Christians who prohibit their teens from using cell phones and accessing the internet, the mental health of their children is much stronger because they're using their religious beliefs and values and community to prohibit access to the internet. And what's so destructive for girls is to constantly compare themselves to others.
That is mm-hmm. huge. I have a 16 and a 17-year-old girl, and I'm going through all of this right now. And you're absolutely right. It's huge. I actually took our 17-year-old and said, get out of the house. We can't be in the house anymore. Get out of the house. You guys go do stuff. For the last 2 years, we've forced them to leave the house. Don't sit in your room, read this stuff, and get depressed about something that somebody said who you'll never meet. He's a friend of a friend. He's a cousin of a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. Made a comment.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right on target because I'm actually living this as we speak.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Struggling with the same things. And I was curious, where does attention seeking kind of fall in that, in the parameters or in the steps of that? Because it seems that, at least from my experience with my child, that it all circumvents around attention seeking and her ability to control that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that there's attention seeking always in kids, especially if they're not getting what they want from
What they need.
School or from home. And I'm not putting anything on anybody because my daughters have had some of these same issues. And it's a matter of trying to get into their past to see if there was something. With my oldest daughter, who's now 27, she told me about 4 years ago that there was something I said when she was about 13 that affected her. Mm. It was just a sentence.
Yeah.
It was just a quip. Just a quip that was an offhand remark. Mm-hmm. And she said, for several years, that bothered her.
Yeah.
And she knew that I loved her, and she knew that I respected her, and she knew all of these things. But that little remark from this guy in her life affected her. Yeah. So there are things that are said all over the place.
That you don't even know. I have the exact same experience with my dad. And when I was like 23 or something, I got super drunk and I called my dad on the phone and I was like, Dad, you said this one thing.
I know.
And he was just like, oh, I didn't mean it like that. You
exactly.
know, like, this opportunity. But you know, I mean, it all kind of goes back to that same thing, the shames that we harbor, the fears that we harbor and the ways that we have culturally set ourselves up to keep those things to ourselves.
Exactly.
Instead.
That is. Yep. So I just dealt with this 2 days ago with the boyfriend. He was angry because he thought it was my fault that the cat was dying. He had not asked question as about why and what was going on. Mm-hmm. And he thought it was something else. And he took it out on me. And I went to my wife and I said, if he talks to me like that, he can't come here again.
Yeah.
And then yesterday I said, okay, you and I need to talk.
Yeah.
So let me tell you the truth. This is what actually happened. And I'm the one that called the vet. And I'm the one that called the vet the second time. And I'm the one that did this. And I understand you being upset. However, in this family, if you want to be a part of this family, you have a problem, you come to me and you say, I said, do you doubt that if I had a problem with you, I'd come to you? He says, well, no, you'd come to me. I said, so you never have to worry. So you got to get over the fear of, that's what I've tried to teach all of my kids, get over the fear of either lying to me about something stupid that nobody cares about, because that's what they lie about, or not being able to tell us something that, by golly, you need help with, and I may not be able to be the one to help you, but I can get you somebody who can. Yeah. And trying to get to the point where, you know, as humans, even in relationships, I tell them, we lie, you know, people lie in relationship all the time because I'm in a relationship with you and I don't want you to know how bad I am because I still want you to stay in my life. So I'm going to hide all this stuff from you.
Shame. Now,
my wife hates that because I tell her everything. And I got to tell you, it's not always a good thing.
No, I, you know, but this is what we're talking about. Because we're, you know, and this, even this concept, I mean, it goes all the way back, Carrie, to that funeral that you led in your tiny community. Where in this family who was a pillar in this community, they lost a child, you know, they lost a child that ended his own life. And rather than walking into that funeral and telling everybody, but it's going to be okay or whatever, you said, some things are like, it's a disease. Some things, just like a cancer that you couldn't necessarily stop, because that gives, and it says, you said that family was so grateful because it addressed that secret shame that we all have, which is if something bad happens to us, it's because God's mad at us. You know, we all look at the book of Job and we're like, oh, you know, look what God did to him. So I better, you know, instead of just recognizing, like you'd said, sometimes these things happen. You know, and we just have to get into a place where we're capable of trusting and loving one another enough to overcome the shame. And it's a, and it's a particular shame that in the Christian community, it's especially salient.
Oh, especially as Catholics, because, you know, we've got guilt on top of it.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Jews and Catholics got guilt cornered. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. You own the market. But I mean, that's what I mean, you know? So when you have these Christian communities that are experiencing these losses, those are the places where for some reason it's the hardest.
Yeah.
To get the love and the support and the people that are capable of sitting with you. Yeah, I can't tell you how many funerals I've been to where it's just, let's skip over the grief part and talk about when we're going to see them in heaven someday.
Well, it's all that PC stuff too. Let's not offend anybody.
Oh,
instead of, let's just be real for a minute.
Yeah, let's just sit here and talk about this.
If you're angry with me, then come up later and we can have a chat. But this is, I'm not here for the guy in the back that's angry. I'm here for the family. Mm-hmm. And for my community here and trying to help everybody heal. And this is, let's not evade the truth. Let's take a look at it and talk about what it really is. You know, this is.
You know what? There's kind of a red thread in here. And I think it's that the struggles we have as parents, as siblings, as partners, these are really high stake relationships and they're very complex. And often we experience the struggles at our lowest moments of the day when we have least resources. And then out of that comes like a lot of moral stress, a lot of spiritual struggles. You know, how can I be a better parent? Like this is what Jonathan Haidt writes about when he would go and talk. So many parents coming to him in just terrible distress about their kids. And it's so hard to talk about that. I mean, you just all trust each other and can share these little snapshots of these struggles as you just did right now because you trust each other and you trust that God, the incarnated God in Jesus, knows those kind of struggles so we can bring them here without fear of being judged, you know?
Yeah.
But it's really hard to find those places to bring those struggles.
This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether in your home, auto, suitcase, or hotel room, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know your items are secured in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistols by make and model, compact size, or full size. They also come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designer protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So protect what matters most. Visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. Enter code Burrows at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter the code Burrows at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
Well, and society's different than it used to be. It used to be everybody lived in a, you know, 800 square foot, one bedroom place, and mm-hmm. everybody was at the kitchen table for dinner. You spent all day, every day, you know, with your kids, the daughters with their mom, the guys with their dads out on the farm or at work. And so there was so much of this growing them up. I mean, the people I know that are from the farm, you know, my dad, my ex, come from the farm, big families, you know, they're all very, very close, and almost none of them have these kind of issues.
Well, and Stephen Glenn is a parenting coach, right? Stephen Glenn is a happy, healthy habits, happy child. Anyhow, Stephen Glenn, he's a psychologist, but he talks a lot about how when we made that shift from farm life to kind of like living in homes and in suburbs, that our kids also lost their sense of purpose, because when you're on the farm, you collected eggs because you needed to. Like, you're a vital part. And that's what's right. Like, our children missing is you're a vital part of our family.
Oh, yeah. At 12 years old, at 8 years old, they were doing things and accomplishing things. I mean, that's one of the things I've tried to do with my kids is, you know, what I need to do a brake job on the car. I bring the girls out. You're going to do this. I don't want to do this. I'm never going to have to do that. You're right. You're never going to have to, but I'm going to have you do this. And just recently, my daughter had a problem with the car, and she called me. She said, okay, so what about this? And I said, well, this is probably this, but okay, we'll look into it. And then when she came home the next day, I took out my machine, I plugged it in, and I read the codes, and I'm like, oh, that's an easy one. And I looked around the car, and I couldn't find it. And then finally, I was, oh, she didn't put the gas cap on. So when she came home, I gave her the machine in her hand. I had her sit in the front seat of the car.
Yeah.
I said, read the instructions and do this and pull a code.
Yeah.
So I made her do it. So she has that accomplishment that, hey, I can do this.
Yeah.
Breaks down on the road, she knows she can change a tire. She has her oil. These things they're building her self-esteem. And these are things that we don't do anymore, you know, on the farm, like you say. And when we were kids, we went camping and we did this and we did this and we all had to do these things. And we don't do that as much anymore. Yeah. Come home and watch TV.
Simple accomplishment is an incredible thing. You don't have to do magical stuff. You just have to finish a thing, almost anything, and then do almost anything else. And if you can see any little job through and just keep doing that, it's incredible how good that is for you. Yeah. And I don't want to be old man about it, because I roll my eyes every time stuff like this is said. But like, the problem with social media is that's like, there's no good job. Like, there's kind of a good job. There's like a like, but there's never a like. Doesn't mean I got a like, I can put this down and do something else. That's not what that means.
No,
ever.
It's like a dopamine hit.
You saw that one today, hon, too, huh?
Yeah.
What?
You saw that TikTok today too, huh? About like.
Oh, no.
Oh, there's one out there. There's one there today about like. Yeah. That's the other thing, too, is people are not doing things. They're experiencing them on TikTok. So they're watching these videos of everyone else doing these things, and they're not doing them. But they think they can do them, and they think this and this. So they have this fake reality.
But the fact of the remains, right? So if this, then that. So even if we did all these things, there might still be people in our lives, and there might still be situations that require us as Christians to remember to have compassion and to create spaces of conversation and let people just sit in grief.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that I know everything.
No, I know.
I'm on my fourth kid and I still screw up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to boil happiness down to learning to bake cookies and then learning to do brake pads. I'm not, in no way, shape, or form was
that's
that my
cure
point.
For mental illness. Yeah.
But you're
yeah.
right. I mean, you're right, Andy. In a way, it's like I heard that it just simply just make your bed every morning.
It wasn't the cure for my daughter, but it got her out of the house and
absolutely.
It got her distracted.
No, I think you're
so
right.
That she didn't, so she wasn't sitting in her room realizing she didn't have a life and these people were saying things about her. She was out so busy that she had less time for that. And she found that she cared, she gave a crap less what people started to say about her.
And I hope that this generation, you know, I hope that there's this opportunity for this generation to experience, you know, coming out of their own mental health issues, you know, coming out of, and because they're going to grow up and they're going to see that, oh, if I put my phone down and go outside, it'll be better. And I'm really curious what they're going to bring to society and to culture when they start talking about that and they start making the discussion around their mental health a normal everyday conversation, you know, so that, you know, people like Sarita aren't left out in the cold without the support that she needed.
Yeah, feeling completely alone.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm going to say something that's controversial is there's not enough suck it up buttercup. We've become such a PC world that you can't spank your kid, you can't discipline your kid, you can't be rough on your kid when they're going through something and teach them. When we were kids, if we cried too long, mom said, hey, keep crying and I'll give you something to cry about. But you let a kid cry for 2 hours, they're going to start getting depressed, or they're going to feel such a release afterwards that they're going to want to continue to do that. So I think we still need to be compassionate.
Yeah.
But I do still think that we need to get in there and say, hey, you know, come on, figure this stuff out because you're not going to be here forever.
I'm not sure it's quite that simple, but I like the spirit that it comes from.
I might say that slightly differently. So, but what I'm hearing and how I would interpret that in my own parenting is what I would do is if my kid was crying for a long period of time, what I'm recognizing is they don't have the skills to self-soothe.
Exactly.
And so when you go in there as the parent, you give them the skills to self-soothe. And I'll say that to my kid. I'll say, hey, you know, when she's really, really upset about something, I'm like, I know you can't have this thing you really want. Let's think of something that you do really want that you know, let's think of something else that you like you can't have, you know, and I teach her those skills.
It's okay to let your kid fall off a bike without rushing over to him really quick and let them get up on their own and let them figure it out and then say, okay.
I want to jump in here because I think what's so helpful about Jonathan Haidt's work is that these problems now with how girls' self-esteem is so tied to their experience of the internet and boys get very, very, very immersed in gaming. This is beyond anything we can do as individual parents or grandparents. So he has, the last chapter of the book and his website has steps to get schools to establish rules that phones get locked up.
Yep.
I mean, he's talking about how kids are constantly, even in school,
even in their classes,
their attention is divided between their phone and school.
You're absolutely right.
Yes, so he has these steps because we are now in a social movement that is way beyond anything one of us could do as a parent or grandparent with their kids. We have to enlist the community because we have to make like changes in our culture.
You know, and
I think we need to talk to them about the changes though, because I can honestly tell my daughter, which I just said earlier today, I honestly don't know some of the things you're going through. Because of I didn't go through that. So your generation is going to have to help us figure this out.
Tell us how we can support you.
The trouble is they can't. So what Jonathan Haidt is saying is their brains have been rewired. It's like someone who has a genetic predisposition to addiction. And, you know, I can take a drink and have too many drinks the first time, you know, as a teenager, and I won't necessarily then develop an addiction, but some people have a predisposition and they will become an addict.
Oh, absolutely.
But that's what he's saying, that
but there's hope for the generation. I mean, there's hope
right,
for.
But we have to do something about it.
I know, but we can't do everything. And I'll say that by telling this story. My youngest, everyone in here knows, is a problem child and has been for a long time. And she's getting better. Where she made one step forward and four steps back, it is now four steps forward and a half step back. And she's 16. No, she just turned 17. Huh. On Sunday. So
nice.
We were talking. And we were talking about phones, and I was talking about this book, and she said, there's no way in hell my kid's going to have a cell phone. And she goes, and she's going to have every parental control there is, believe you me, there's just no way. And she's going to start out with a flip phone. Now, this is a 17-year-old who used to sneak phones and do this and sneak everything and sneak out and get high and do pills and everything else. And she is saying, oh, hell no. I know what these kids are capable of, and I know what they're doing, and my kid is not going to have one because I'm going to be there to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Well,
so
I'm a millennial, and so I was in the Wild West, right? I remember when the internet was new, and I was in the eighth grade, you know? And so I remember going into chat rooms and, like, all the stuff that people would talk about and the fact that there was no boundaries and, like, no filters. So, yeah, we are a big fan of turn the internet off at night in our house. We have no phone rule from 6 to 9. That's family time. And we are establishing that not just with our kids, but with us as the parents. Because if we want our kids to get off our phones and our tablets, then parents, we need to get off of our phones and our tablets.
Oh, yeah.
We need to get off the internet.
There's no phones.
We need to get off TikTok, you know?
There's no phones at dinner time.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, and Dr. Doering, I want to be sensitive to your time because it's 6:59 and I know that you've got other commitments that you need to get to. So I just want to thank you for your bravery and for your transparency and for coming here and for chatting with us about something that's so personal. And I'm just so grateful to you for coming and for being here today.
Well, yes, and I think that our conversation tonight shows that if we can share these kind of struggles with each other, there's a ripple effect. Mm. And then we bring in other struggles, you know, struggles of parents. And then we create sort of strategies together, like you've all been exchanging different strategies that work for you. And so now, instead of just struggling with these things on our own, we're building this network where we're giving each other support and we're trying to figure things out.
Which is really what community is all about, right?
Takes a village to raise a village.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, Dr. Doering, thanks again so much for being here. And
thank you.
You know, we usually end each one of our episodes. So we start with the same question and we end with the same question. So iCandy's been awful quiet over there. So we're going to hear the dulcet tones of Billy iCandy Kimsey.
Yeah. So, Carrie, so can I ask you a quick question? So when you're... when you, I'm going to air quote, die or just your body shuts down, what do you think happens? Do you automatically go to heaven? You have a rest? I like to ask that to every guest we have on here.
Well, this is where my skeptical side comes out, because I honestly think death is death. It's the end. That's my own personal view.
Okay.
And I'm also not afraid of death, at least at this point in my life. I'm turned 70 in 2 weeks, and I have very clear advanced directives for my son. If I have dementia, I don't want to linger.
Gotcha.
So I have a very strong sense of self-agency towards death and what I want to try to be as good a death as possible. But once I die, I know that my memory will live on in other people, but I personally do not believe that I will exist beyond that.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Good answer.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. Thank you so much for being here. And folks, thanks for tuning in. Again, you know, if you have any questions, please reach out. If you're looking for resources, please reach out. We are here for you, and we love you guys.
Is there anything, like maybe her email address again?
She did, Dr. Doering, go ahead.
Tell me to give it again?
Yeah, that'd be great.
My first initial C, and my last name, it's a German spelling. It's a little hard to understand, but it's D-O-E as in elephant, H as in Harry, then ring, R-I-N-G, at, and it's the name of my school. L as in Larry, F as in Frank, FAsInFrank.edu.
C Doering and at iLift.edu.
Yes. And if you email me, I can send you the article I wrote that gives a lot of sharing about what it was like to pull together a funeral service.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks again. And listeners, thanks You're for welcome. Tuning in. Thanks everyone for being here.
Awesome.
And we'll see y'all next time on the Burrows of Berea.
Thank you.
Peace out. Later.
Hey guys, this is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. Do you know how much blood, sweat, and tears it takes to make a podcast? None. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't cost a lot. And so if you guys don't mind, if anybody would like to give to help us with these episodes, it would be great. We'll put out even more content. And if you go to our Patreon page, just search for the Burrows of Berea, you'll get extra notes, extra episodes, and it's pretty much free. A dollar gets you a lot. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again so much for being here and having this conversation with us. I really appreciate it. This was lovely. Yeah, thank you.
It was so interesting to parachute into your world.
Yeah. And it's real. Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad I got to share that with you specifically. So I'm really grateful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I mean, I hope to see you again at some point. I think we'll run across each other again.
I think so. I'll certainly, if I'm in town, I'll make it to Isle of Graduation.
Yeah. See, and once COVID, once I start back to COVID, once COVID restrictions are normal, see, I never have been on campus yet because the entire time I was in school, it was COVID.
Gosh.
And so I never even got to be on campus. I never got to go to gathering days. I never got to be a part of it. I know. And I still get the emails. So I'm just like chomping at the bit to get back to my studies because I love my 2 years at ILF. I got one more if I'm going to finish my MDiv, but still waiting on some direction and for my kids. To be in school. I have an 18-month-old now, too.
Email me because there's some new developments about MDivs that will be to your advantage.
Oh, okay. I will. I'll email you. Oh, thank you so much. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon then. Good night. Okay. I'll end the Zoom.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, Ralph.
What's up?
Ralph lost a kitty cat.
Oh, no.
Put it down. She had kidney failure.
That's a big problem with cats. Like, you can't get them to drink, especially on hard food diets, which we largely feed. They don't drink enough water. And you could, they found some sort of vaccine or something that's directly kidney related that looks like it will, in general, extend the lives of house cats like a third or some absurd amount because so many of them succumb apparently to some sort of kidney failure because
dry cat food sucks the water out of their systems.
And they're not given to drinking water. That's not how they kind of get most of their moisture in the wild.
Well, I guess I'll never get kidney failure then.
Because you eat more than dry cat food?
Yeah, my cat.
I drink lots of water.
Yeah. I'm going to click you up one, Teezy. You sound like you're a mile away. Hold on.
My cat drinks like a fish.
Isn't that a song? A million miles away.
Is it?
It is.
Oh, okay.
when it comes to music.
It is a song. Ralph knows. Ralph's not joking.
I mean, you know, how could there not be a song with the hook a million miles away, to be frank?
I know. Okay.
That's funny.
All right.
Yeah, everybody but Billy. We'll just work him in when he happens.
Ready?
Yeah. We're rolling.
All right.